Okay, good afternoon. I'll call to order meeting the State Government Budget Division for Monday, February 2, 2009. The first item that we have on today's agenda is a report by the legislative auditor dealing with some internal audit controls in state agencies. A few of us were on the audit commission, myself, Senator Ress, Senator Roebling. We've heard some reports, and we've seen sort of a common theme coming through a number of the recent audits with some issues that are of concern to us. And Mr. Nobles, welcome back to the Budget Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me at the table is Cecile Ferkel, who is the deputy legislative auditor for the Financial Audit Division. And thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for inviting us to be here. There has been a lot of attention in recent days to some of the financial management issues in Minnesota state government. And while we certainly don't like to find problems, we think some good things may come out of this increased focus and attention. And in fact, we've already seen the Commissioner of Finance and others in state government in their meetings with us and in meetings with legislators really offer some insights and suggestions on how some of those issues can be addressed in the future. So we certainly want to get good things out of this difficult patch of news about financial management in state government. I think, Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to do is have Cecile Ferkel just tell you a little bit more about how we go about auditing in state government and some of the financial management issues that we have uncovered. So I will probably have a few words to say after she does that. But at this point, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to call on Cecile Ferkel.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Ferkel. Welcome to the Budget Division. We'll need you to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. I'm Cecile Ferkel. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Financial Audit Division. And we have about 40 auditors in our division. They are CPAs, people with accounting degrees. Much of our office is fairly new staff with less than 3 years of experience. We've gone through a pretty aggressive effort to train and provide those auditors with the skills they need to go into state agencies and take a look at the fiscal controls. We spend about half of our time during the year auditing the state's financial statements. That's a big effort on our part, and also compliance with federal programs. But about the other half of the year, maybe a little less than half of the year, we go through a process to identify different state agencies, committees, commissions, or boards within state government that we believe would be a good place for us to go in and do some audit work and see what their fiscal operations look at. And I'd like to talk about what our focus is in these audits. We refer to them as internal control and compliance audits, but we're really looking for some basic fiscal management practices within those agencies. And I think I can boil it down to about three different areas that we look at. First of all, we're looking to see whether or not the management of the entity has used its financial resources in a prudent way and in compliance and within the limits of laws and statutes. So we're looking to see whether or not they're using their resources for the purpose that they were given those resources, for the intended purpose, and whether or not they're using those resources within the limits of the law, within the limits of state policy. And sometimes the agency also has developed its own policies, so we look at within whether or not they're using their resources within those limits. We also look to see whether or not they are protecting the assets that they have. And those assets can be a variety of things. For some agencies, they collect receipts, and we're looking at whether or not they protect those receipts until they safely get those receipts in the bank. We also look at whether or not they're protecting their fixed assets. That could be their furniture, it could be their buildings, it could be their equipment, their computers. Also, we're looking at it. And one of the best ways to protect their assets is to make sure that they have a record of their assets, and that at least once every 2 years, which is state policy, that they compare their record of assets to the assets that actually exist. So do they know where they're at? Do they know what their assets are? And do they know where their assets are? So we do look at their fixed assets and how well they protect those things. Also, some agencies have some kind of unique kinds of assets. When we were at the Department of Health, we found that they buy gift cards that they use as incentives to help people that have certain illnesses to seek treatment, to encourage them to participate in programs that health research, perhaps, that health is conducting. But we didn't find that the department really had good control over those gift cards. It was kind of interesting to us. It was something we hadn't seen before. These are gift cards valued at $5 or $10, but they had almost $200,000 worth of gift cards in the agency that were kept in boxes on a shelf in somebody's cubicle. So we didn't feel that they had good control over those. And to us, a gift card is almost like cash. In fact, it's even a little more vulnerable than cash would be, because a gift card can be used on the internet, and it still looks like, I'm sure you've found gift cards that your kids have received, you know, through the years. Is there any value on this? You can't tell just by looking at it. Whereas if you look at a $5 bill, you know there's still $5 of value there. So we saw little notes in these records that a gift card had been borrowed or a gift card would be repaid by an employee. So we really felt that an asset like that was really not being well protected. Another kind of interesting thing that we found was an asset such as a license or a certificate that somebody will pay a fee in order to receive. We found that there weren't good controls over those kinds of assets at some agencies too. So if somebody, if a state employee can just start handing out licenses in exchange for some other fee or maybe for nothing, just to a friend, that really is a valuable asset that the state has, the actual certificate or license that they get. And we did see some discrepancies at Barbers Board and Board of Cosmetology, where there were missing licenses. That licenses seemed to have been issued, but where was the money? The money wasn't deposited in the bank. So licenses and certificates, again, are another kind of asset that we look at. And we also look at data as an asset. This is something that we've started doing in the last few years, that beyond the equipment that the data is stored on, the data itself is something of value, and it's something that the state agencies need to have good controls to protect. So we also look at data protection and information protection within the agencies. So the third thing that we look at, so we look at, are they using their resources prudently in accordance with the law? Are they protecting their assets? And the third thing that we look at is, are they recording their financial activity in the accounting records accurately? So when they process a payment, did they make that payment to the right person? Was it for the right dollar amount? Does it agree with the invoice? Is it the employee's right rate of pay? We're checking those details, too. And really, it does get down to a very detailed level of testing when we're looking at individual transactions. And you know, one of the things that we found in one of our recent audits was at the Department of Labor and Industry, we found that they had made a payment to someone who had filed a workers' comp claim. The payment was supposed to have gone to the insurance company. It was for over $50,000. By mistake, the department processed the payment to the person who was injured. The insurance company never missed it, and the person who got that $50,000 check in the mail didn't realize or didn't report that they had received it in error. And the department now, after our audit, had to go back and make the payment to the proper person and try to recover the missed payment of funds. So looking at those details, that a state agency should be able to make an accurate payment to the right person. That's a part of the good fiscal management that we're trying to achieve. So in doing our audits, that's what we're looking for: how they're using their resources, how they're recording their transactions, are they processing their transactions accurately? And through the last over the last few months, we've issued a series of reports that identify what we think are pretty significant weaknesses in those areas, and also what we think seems to be kind of a pattern across state agencies, that these important fiscal management principles need to be addressed within state government.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just add to that, the focus really in the last few days, last couple of weeks, has really been on the auditors. And that's fine. We've been doing our work, as Ms. Ferkel just pointed to, and we issue reports, and so naturally there is often focus on our findings and our recommendations. But we think that what this all tells us is there really needs to be more focus on management, because we're not going to audit our way to good financial management, good government. These really are management functions that need to be fulfilled. Auditors can come in periodically and determine whether or not internal controls are adequate, and they can point to weaknesses. But auditors only come infrequently to most state agencies. Even some of the larger state agencies, but certainly the smaller ones, we get to only ever once in a while, especially as our resources have diminished. There really needs to be in place on an ongoing daily basis the internal controls that ensure that payments are made under proper authorization, that assets are secured, that money gets in the bank, that bank accounts are reconciled, all of those kinds of things that are the basic business functions of state government. And what I'm saying is not something that is new. It's really a matter of established practice, both in the public sector and the private sector, that it is management's responsibility to understand the risks that are involved in their business transactions, to design and implement internal controls to mitigate those risks. It is really not appropriate that management only sees the problems when auditors come in and find them. They need to be engaged in this day in and day out. Now, the issue is, whose responsibility is that? And we think that it's the responsibility of every commissioner, every executive director in state government to take care of those responsibilities. But we also think there is an increased role for the Department of Finance to emphasize internal controls, to offer guidance, to offer monitoring of those controls. And so we've frequently in some of our audits reports pointed to the need for a stronger role from the Department of Finance, and I know that the commissioner is here and is going to address that issue. So, Mr. Chairman, again, we thank you for the attention that you're giving these issues. We'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Yes, a couple of things. We do have a packet here that kind of gives some summaries of the selected control and compliance audits that you've done recently. And from the Audit Commission, I mean, we've seen various things like, inattention to cell phone use, mileage use, and so forth. Can you kind of comment on some of the trends that you're seeing that, you know, I mean, overall, some things that you're finding as you look in all these agencies and boards?
Mr. Chair, some of the issues that we're seeing this year in many of these audits, we did focus on areas like travel and cell phone and purchase cards, and that was a result of some issues raised at the Department of Transportation in relation to the Sonia Pitt issues that we looked at about a year ago. We decided to see that review of Sonia Pitt's activities identified poor controls in the department over cell phones, purchase card transactions, and travel expenditures. So we wanted to see in other state agencies how well other agencies are controlling those issues. And we defined pretty consistent poor controls over cell phone use. Cell phones are an area that has changed, evolved, as I'm sure all of you are aware, over the last 10 years, where a cell phone used to be kind of a rare thing, kind of a special privilege given to an employee, and now it's a fairly common thing. There are agencies with thousands of employees that have cell phones and need them as a part of doing their work. Department of Natural Resources, for example, their employees travel all around the state. They need to have cell phones. But what we found was that departments were, as the cost of cell phones decreased, the departments were really not watching cell phone use. They kind of considered it just a cost of doing business. Our concern with cell phones really focuses on what the expectations of the federal government is in terms of employee benefits and the IRS regulations. The state agencies need to have really stringent cell phone controls in order to comply with IRS regulations about whether or not these are a business, something provided by the state as a way of doing business, or whether or not this is a benefit to employee. And we really found only one small division within an agency that was really doing a good job of it. So we felt this is an exposure throughout the state and something that needs to be addressed in some way. In travel, when we looked at travel, what we felt that we were seeing was that agencies relied on, in the business departments within an agency, they relied on the supervisors to be reviewing whether or not the travel was appropriate and complied with state union contracts or personnel plans. When we talked to the supervisors, they thought the business offices were checking on those things. And in the end, really nobody was looking at it. We did find an employee at the Department of Labor and Industry that over the course of 3 years and at 50 cents a mile managed to obtain over $10,000 of inappropriate mileage. So, you know, that really takes some determination on the part of an employee to, you know, pad every mileage claim with some extra miles in order to get that additional $10,000 over some period of time. But, again, the department, the supervisor was not looking at and assessing whether or not those mileage charges were appropriate. The department was processing the claim because the supervisor's signature was on it. We found this in several other audits, too. So Purchase cards we felt seemed to be pretty well controlled and reviewed by supervisors. We really didn't find any significant problems there, other than some lack of documentation at the department level about did they review the policies, did employees sign off on the right forms before they got the purchase cards, and did they know the rules. We didn't find exceptions in purchase cards where people were using them for inappropriate purchases.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just mention one other thing that is, I think, really important that has come to light as an issue just recently, and that is what we call incompatible access and incompatible duties. And I think that this is something that most people feel is only auditors or accountants would really raise as an issue. Seems rather abstract. And you don't typically read about a scandal or some sort of mischief being created by incompatible access. We actually see a good deal of incompatible access to the accounting system and people performing duties that allow them to, for example, authorize a payment to a vendor, and in the case that we're looking at now, also obtain that payment and then use it inappropriately. And so we will soon be reporting on a case. We'll have a document that will outline for you the details of what occurred in that case. It's one that's already been in the media to some degree, and that's the fraud at the Department of Human Services. And I think it will illustrate very clearly why incompatible access to the accounting system in particular and a person having incompatible duties is really an issue that we emphasize over and over and over again, even when we don't find that a fraud or a misappropriation of funds has been committed. Because when we find incompatible access, incompatible duties, we see the potential. And we see that potential around state agencies a lot. And again, this is something that we can go in and point out as a problem, but it's something that needs to be corrected on an ongoing basis in an agency, because people change. People leave. People come in. Duties change. And each agency needs to assess what the duties are of individual people, particularly those who have access to the accounting system, to ensure that they are not performing incompatible duties or have incompatible access, and where they find a situation, particularly in a small agency, where that may be necessary because they don't have enough people to separate those duties, they need to find mitigating controls to ensure that that access is not being used for an inappropriate purpose. So, again, I think sometimes we go to agencies, maybe even we can come to legislative committees, and we can talk about this particular issue, and it's not quite as tangible as a cell phone or a purchase card. And as I said, this week, I think possibly Wednesday, Thursday, we will be issuing to you a document that will explain exactly how the fraud at the Department of Human Services was committed, and a very important part of how it was committed was a person having incompatible access performing incompatible duties.
One of the reports that you did recently, a personal care attendant, highlighted a particular issue that, I mean, you had personal care attendants that were billing more than 24 hours a day and clearly overbilling, but nobody was catching it. And is that something that we're seeing through the agencies that we're, you know, we've, in the area of budget cuts, we've eliminated the very staff whose job it is to kind of watch this and double check some of these things so that we're having more of this simply because we don't have the people to watch them within the agencies. Is that what you're seeing across the board?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that sort of issue brings a couple of things to mind. There are payment systems in state government. I think we all understand that process thousands, tens of thousands. Frankly, some payment systems process millions of transactions. And so you can't have a person or even an army of people sitting there going through each payment. And so the first thing you need to do is, again, examine your business functions, your business activities. And certainly in this case, making payments to vendors is a very common one and typically done by in an electronic way. And so you need to look at how you can build into those electronic payment systems certain edits that will simply not allow certain things to occur. And that is one I would suggest should have been built into the payment system that simply would not have allowed that to occur. Now, sometimes you build into electronic payment systems, a payroll system, other kinds of systems, edits that will flag a certain kind of transaction that then somebody does need to look at. And again, I guess I would point to the fraud situation at the Department of Human Services where, again, large electronic payment systems were being used. And we think that the person who perpetrated that fraud was able to understand the edits in those various systems in a way that she was able to perpetrate the fraud. But if there had been the kind of human monitoring of those payments, we think there would have been some red flags related to this woman's processing of certain kinds of transactions that would have come to a supervisor's review. And at the very least, somebody would have asked questions. Why is Kim Austin, the person who perpetrated the fraud, and I'm not revealing anything because that's been in the newspapers, why is she repeatedly processing certain kinds of transactions in a certain way? Because they were out of the normal way of processing those transactions that should have been red flags that a person, her supervisor, or other officials at the department should have then taken a look, asked questions, and that simply didn't occur. So, again, Mr. Chairman, you know, state government is a very large, complicated financial enterprise, and there are going to be large electronic payment systems that are going to process a lot of payments. Some things are going to be done by paper and human beings, and we need to use all of the tools, all of the internal controls that are available in whatever way we're processing those financial transactions to ensure that the payments are properly authorized and properly reviewed.
I've got one or two other things I wanted to hit before I open it to other questions. One of the things that you highlighted with the Competitive Sports Commission was it was a new commission, and the commissioner, Ledoux, in his response to some of the problems, has said, well, this commission was created. Nobody ever sat us down and told us, here's what we're supposed to do. Here's what is going to happen. And so that was his claim. And I think the Audit Commission said that there seems to be some understanding of that may be happening. Because as we look through, a lot of the small boards and groups seem to run into a lot of problems because there's doesn't seem to be a lot of oversight. Is that your analysis as well, too? Ms. Ferkel?
Mr. Chair, we do I think that small agencies and small commissions do struggle to understand the full scope of their responsibilities, what statutes apply to them, what policies do they need to operate under, what rules do they need to follow. And that is, when we get into those smaller agencies, that often is where we find some weakness. But I do want to point out that to my surprise, we get into some big agencies and we find some of the same problems sometimes, you know, a lack of awareness of certain policies and a lack of awareness of certain laws. You know, an agency that maybe isn't aware that they have only 24 hours to get their money in the bank and they better figure out a way to do it. And yet they've created processes that inherently are going to take 2 to 3 days where that money is floating around within from one desk to another desk to another desk. So it really surprises me when I see something like that in a big agency. And I think a need for state agencies, large and small, to really identify what laws apply, refocus on those things, what laws apply to us, what policies apply to us, is expected of us, and how are we going to get it done?
Mr. Chairman, if I might just go back to the issue of small agencies, because I think, although I certainly agree totally with Ms. Ferkel, that it's surprising sometimes when you find in large agencies, I would point again to the Department of Human Services is certainly one of our largest, with a lot of people there who should be attentive to these kinds of issues. But there is a special set of problems, I think, with the small agencies, and we have a lot of them. And I think during this financial crisis, it would be very helpful for this committee and others with jurisdiction over the finances of Minnesota state government to take a real hard look at how we've structured and organized and operate these small entities. They are literally, physically scattered around in multiple locations. And I think as a first step towards just efficiency, that we could look at some greater co-location of these, which I think would lead to not only saving money, but possibly a better awareness of their administrative and financial responsibilities. I think certainly they could share copy machines, they could share receptionists, but they could also have one or two or three strong, really well-informed financial managers who goes to the training, who is connected with the Department of Finance in a way that they do understand better than the multitude of financial managers we have now who are sort of scattered all over state government in a myriad of small organizations. The Combative Sports Commission, I think, is just illustrative of a bigger problem, but it is definitely illustrative of a problem where the legislature creates an entity, the governor makes the appointment, and in this case, the governor appointed the executive director, Mr. Ledoux, of this commission. And he had one other employee to do all of these various business functions that come with being a state entity in state government. His claim was that he was not well informed about his responsibilities. I think you could hear a different version from others within the executive branch who felt they tried to inform Mr. Ledoux of his responsibilities, but there were still problems. So whichever story is closer to being accurate, the reality is still the same, in that we had a state entity, small admittedly, but still doing state business in a way that was just frankly shockingly inappropriate. From beginning to end. I mean, there wasn't any aspect of the operation of the Combative Sports Commission that was being, or possibly still is, being administered appropriately, from taking cash in hand and getting it maybe to the bank some days later, to operating a website that was completely corrupted with viruses and malware. A website, by the way, Mr. Chairman, that takes in data that is classified as private, but which is completely accessible through hacking. Again, admittedly a small entity, but that is still state government.
Members, we are going to be having some of our small boards in on Wednesday of this week, and so we'll have an opportunity to look at the boards of color and talk about some of the issues that they've got in managing some of these very issues. But in the bigger scheme of things, Mr. Nobles, last month you responded to a request from Representative Winkler, and I hope you can amplify on this comment that you made. You said that the Commissioner of Finance is more than just the head of a single department. He's also the state's chief financial officer with wide-ranging responsibilities for the overall well-being of the state's financial operations. Can you tie that into, you know, the overall operations and the things that we should be looking at? Because although, you know, we have a list of other boards with our, beyond our jurisdiction, we do have the oversight over finance or Minnesota management and budget, and so we need to figure out, you know, what we need to ask of them and make sure that they are properly exercising their oversight function with all these issues that you're identifying.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and members, and Tom Hansen's here, and he and I have talked about this a good deal in recent days, and I'm happy that you have him here to hear directly from him about his perspective. But I go back to something I said earlier, and that is the basic principle that what we're talking about, having good internal controls, is a management responsibility, first and foremost. And so we have to find a way in state government to ensure that management takes that responsibility very seriously. Now, in state government, we have a particular problem, I think, in that we are so decentralized. We break state government as an enterprise into many pieces. Big, Department of Transportation, DHS, Department of Health, down to what we just talked about, the very small, two people. and much in between. And so state government as an enterprise is broken into many pieces. And we deal with the pieces. We go into the Department of Health or the Combative Sports Commission, and we deal with the pieces. And we get a response. Usually when we have findings, people in charge at those departments and agencies, boards and commissions, tell us, thank you very much for being here. We agree with you. Yes, we fell down on the job, and we'll correct the problem. But sometimes when we go back, as we did recently, for example, at the Minneapolis Veterans Home, we found that the problem hadn't been fixed. Mm-hmm. In fact, the problem had gotten worse. And we've gone to other departments as well, where the last commissioner or deputy commissioner said they were going to fix the problem, but they didn't fix the problem. And more than fixing the specific problem that we found, we want people to have an attitude, a frame of mind, that they're going to look more broadly maybe than just what we found, but they're going to look at their systems in total, periodically, and again, ensure that the internal controls are there so that there won't be problems in the future. And frankly, it's a certain frame of mind that is difficult to get across in some state agencies because their focus is more on their programs, their policies, not on the details of financial management. And yet, every organization in state government is a part of this big financial enterprise. I don't know of a state agency or a state entity that doesn't in some way take in money and spend money. And so all of them are engaged in financial activity. And so we're looking for partners. We're looking for allies that will impress upon the managers of state government that these things are important. Yes, commissioners, deputy commissioners, others in state government principally will have to focus on their policies, on programs, and other kinds of issues that they have to pay attention to. But somebody in every department and agency, no matter how large, how small, has to pay attention to the details of financial management. Again, at Combative Sports, there were two people. Unfortunately, the executive director didn't know a lot about financial management. So what about the other person there? He didn't either. So who's there to pay attention to those things? And so what we are looking for, and what I reflected in that memorandum, was, in a sense, an appeal to the state's chief financial officer, who is so designated, I believe, in Minnesota statutes. Now, I also recognize that it's not just a matter of the Commissioner of Finance being told in law or by me that he is the chief financial officer and he has certain responsibilities. He absolutely has to be backed up, frankly, by the governor, because sometimes push comes to shove. And when there are issues that need to be addressed of a financial nature, and a commissioner of finance picks up the phone and says, you know, commissioner of whatever other agency or executive director, I see the legislative auditor issued this report. What are you going to do about it? I've been around state government long enough to know that there are some commissioners who would say, I was appointed commissioner of the Department of Transportation or Health or whatever, and that's my responsibility, and I'll deal with it. I think that every commissioner, every executive director in state government needs to know from the law, but also from a strong message from the governor, that the commissioner of finance is the chief financial officer of this state, and that anybody who is in state government better pay attention when he calls them and says, what's going on? Why do you have these problems? We expect them to be fixed. And when the legislative auditor comes next time, there better not be a repeat finding. You know, we carry maybe a certain amount of influence and weight, but these people who run state government don't work for us. And we have no enforcement authority. We can really bring to bear no consequence on the people who actually run state government. Other people can. And we're looking for them to help us out and show people who go astray that there are consequences.
Sarah Roster has some questions.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is actually just a minor one, but when you were talking about the theft of money from the Department of Human Services by Ms. Austin, how confident can we be that if someone were to attempt that kind of theft right now, that they have procedures in place that would put up those red flags. As I recall, the reason why we found out about it to start with was someone in a bank in Wisconsin who noted that these deposits she was making and probably subsequent withdrawals just were a bit off, and that bank administrator then contacted the Department of Finance or Human Services or yourself or someone, and then upon further examination, the theft was discovered. But how do we know that someone is not doing the same thing right now?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, we can never sit here on any day of the week on any department and give you that absolute assurance.
But we're talking about things in place to at least prevent it if possible, rather than finding out about it, Mr. Chairman, after the fact. Has the Department of Human Services put policies, procedures, responsibilities, accountabilities in place so that the likelihood that if someone were stealing money from the taxpayers in that agency, it would come to someone's attention and not have to wait for a banker in Wisconsin to call us up and let us know?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, members, the Department of Human Services has changed and strengthened some internal controls. That is their assertion to us and to others. We have not gone back to examine, audit, and test those internal controls. We take them at their word. They understand as well as we do how that fraud was perpetrated. And I think that they have, again, I will take them on their word, that they have strengthened the controls that allowed Kim Austin to do what she did. And there were several weaknesses, internal control weaknesses, that allowed it. And again, we have been asked, and we will provide to you a document that will detail that. But what concerns us, two things really, is, and I said this before, we want agencies to not just plug the holes, but to understand their whole business function, all of their functions and all of the transactions that they engage in, and carefully examine them and understand the potential risks and mitigate those risks. But we want that to go beyond the Department of Human Services, because exactly what Kim Austin did at DHS could potentially be done elsewhere. Has the Department of Health looked at its internal functions and thought through the scenario of an employee there doing what Ms. Austin did? I don't know. And again, that's what brings me to the Commissioner of Finance, because we want people across state government to look at legislative audit reports or issues that come up and ask themselves, could this happen to us? And do we understand our systems well enough, and have we understood the risks and mitigated those risks to the degree that we're reasonably assured that it couldn't? Some of you have heard me say this, but I'll just say it again. We work a lot with the with MNSCU, with the Minnesota State Universities and Colleges, and we really like the model that they follow. I won't go into a lot of details about it, but the Chancellor's Office takes a very firm hand on financial management at MNSCU, and it's my understanding that every college president, university president, is expected to be aware not only very directly of the problems that occur in his or her campus, but at other campuses as well. And the Chancellor's Office, through Mr. Osmussen and the internal audit function, but also through the Vice Chancellor Laura King's office, they really stress that each president of every campus is personally responsible for the financial controls, good financial management on their campus. And they really try to use every audit report as a learning opportunity for the whole enterprise. And what we are trying to get across is, just like MNSCU, Minnesota State Government is an enterprise. Certainly as a financial enterprise, because so many of our systems are interconnected, that we need to look at it much more than we do, and stop looking at it as that's just a problem at the Department of Labor and Industry, or that's just a problem at the Department of Human Services. These potentially are enterprise-wide problems, and they need to be addressed that way, just like we address security issues now. Through the Office of Enterprise Technology, we address those enterprise-wide, and we need to do the same for financial management.
Other questions, Mr. Nobles? I do want to get Commissioner Hansen up here to respond after he's done, but any other questions of the legislative auditor? Senator Rust.
Mr. Chairman, I just would just comment that we have had a bill that was in our committee, and the policy committee will be coming to this division to clarify and strengthen the authority and responsibility of the Commissioner of Finance or Minnesota Management and Budget. I guess we should get used to calling it that. With regard to internal controls and the oversight and training function that we believe should be looked at much more carefully and thoroughly, so that every agency does understand the standards to which they are going to be held accountable by the Chief Financial Officer.
Any other questions to the auditor? Commissioner Hansen, I believe you're here.
I think he stepped down.
Is there somebody from the agency who can respond here?
Here he comes.
Thank you. Welcome back to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. My name is Lori Moe. I'm Assistant Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget.
The Commissioner is here.
Just step down for a minute.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Tom Hansen. I'm the Commissioner of statutorily the Department of Finance and hopefully the Minnesota Department of Management and Budget, if you so choose the name we've selected for ourselves.
Well, that's another issue for another day. But in response to some of the concerns that was raised by the legislative auditor, we need to find out from your perspective what you are doing and what we can do to help ensure that there is proper oversight over all these boards and agencies that are not. Frankly, it looks like they're just letting a lot of the oversight budget issues fall by the wayside, and we want to get a better handle on that. So how do you see it from your perspective, Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I couldn't agree more with the legislative auditor. The pattern of financial responsibility we've seen with some of their latest audit is absolutely unacceptable, and it is something that we have talked extensively with the auditor as well as some of the members of your committee and your House counterparts as well. And I have some thoughts I would like to share with you today, but I think having a hearing like this or other hearings is one of the most important things we can do. But something the legislative auditor said, and I think he and I must use the same term because he said something that pulled right out of my notes. Government is a complex and large operation. We have 50,000 state employees that work for the state or MNSCU. 4,000 of them, in some way, shape, or form, access and use our financial systems, doing about 5 million expenditure transactions, and 30,000 of our employees submit some sort of expense reimbursement over the course of the year. So it's a large, complex organization. It is a shared responsibility, but it is ultimately, from a management perspective, the Department of Finance, Management and Budget's responsibility to oversee and to make sure that these they are financially well managed. Some of the things we are doing, we first of all, with our existing resources, we're starting with a mandatory form with all of our commissioners in about a week where the legislative auditor is going to walk through the findings that he went through today. And I know that as the incoming chair of the Legislative Audit Commission, Senator Rest is on the panel as well. But
that's a bit premature. We haven't met yet.
The gavel is still with the House right now.
Right.
Oh, it is.
We haven't elected a new Senate chair yet, so.
It's coming.
Well, you are in my mind, Senator, so. But it's a, to start, it's the first of ongoing efforts on our department's part to make the senior managers and the senior appointees in our agencies accountable. The other thing, we have upgraded our code of conduct training that has been piloted by four other agencies, ourselves, the Department of Education, the Department of Revenue, and I think MNSCU was the other one. And it's a training program that teaches and discusses and makes managers aware of their financial responsibility and their ethical responsibilities. And it doesn't matter whether you're the governor, myself, or a commissioner, or the head of a unit that's overseeing a program, you have a financial obligation to manage our state's money well. So that's the that's very important. Getting to the issue of the small agencies and boards, we have a form on February 20th for small boards and commissions. And the other thing that we have done that this finance division might be, is probably aware of, is we've established the SMART initiative in the Department of Administration that specifically is designed to perform some of these administrative tasks for these smaller boards and commissions. In addition, we've seen, you know, some of the smaller boards and commissions, like the healthcare boards, have consolidated into one internal human resources and administrative financial unit. We find that is very effective. We could probably spend about 2 hours talking about what went right and wrong with the Combative Sports Commission. It's an example of where at least a half a dozen people in what was old finance, old door, and even elements of admin, including varying degrees myself, interacted with the Combative Sports Commission to try and get them to a point where they understood our policies and procedures. And there's an example of where perhaps all the training in the world help that, and would help that situation, and something more in the lines of SMART, which they eventually did migrate to, that SMART actually doing the transactions for them. Another important component that I see that going forward is important to accountability and financial management is, again, something I think that's in a bill that Senator Rest is moving forward. We will be, at some point in the next month or so, have a searchable database that drills down on down to the vendor and vendor level quite a ways. We will be swinging around to show as many committee members as possible, but making this information accessible is important. So we have the existing resources, we have a responsibility, but I think it can be strengthened by some initiatives we have that are going to be before this committee. One of the issues the legislative auditor commented on at the beginning of his remarks was the access that certain individuals have to the MAP system. We have a antiquated accounting and procurement system that's functionality is based on late 1980s technology that was built in 1994. And because of the limitations, it is difficult for us to.
What's the proper term?
The security in the existing system is not robust, I guess.
Yes, the security is not robust, but it's difficult to add multiple people with differing types of access. It's just by nature a cumbersome system. That's why we have before you a proposal in the governor's budget to upgrade that system. It is in of itself not, you can't just say, well, we're going to now have good financial management because you're going to give us a computer system. It's just a tool in the tool chest that will help us going forward. The other thing we are have proposed is an internal control initiative. And it's adding eight individuals. It's not designed to replace the auditing on the back end. The legislative auditor has 60. We can't mirror that function, in our department by just adding 8 individuals. But this, we are envisioning 2 individuals to work with our capital investment and debt management. We have seen an influx of bonding projects, specifically local projects, in the past few years, and some projects that are fairly unique, and the need to follow up to make sure the constitutional and statutory provisions are being followed is very important. The other 6 we're envisioning to assign to agencies, kind of like our executive budget officer model, where from start to finish, to work with agencies, training and assistance and management on the front end, as well as some oversight on the back end. But auditing in and of itself, we should be able to find the problems before they get there, because once it's found in an audit, the problem's already occurred. And auditing is not, and I think as the legislative auditor indicated, is not the only way to do this, because if it was, then the Department of Human Services has their own audit function. The Department of Transportation has 30 auditors, which is essentially 1/10 of my department, and they still had the Sonia Pitt case, and some of the other bigger agencies that have problems have a very strong auditing function. So it is a combination and a shared responsibility where we focus on management and training on the front end, appropriate auditing on the back end, and frankly, having committees like this and the Legislative Audit Commission aggressively holding us accountable for the decisions we make. I think with that, Mr. Chair, we can open it up.
Well, let me make an observation. I certainly want to open up to other comments or questions by the members here. I mean, we've gone through the past couple of years of budget deficits, and you know, we've heard the talk, we have to reduce government, do more with less, tighten our belts, and so forth. But we seem to be seeing a trend now where more and more of these lack of fiscal oversight issues are coming up, and it just leads me to the conclusion that the people who are being cut are the people who've had that responsibility to oversee some of these things. And when I look across government agencies and I see agencies that have public relations people, press spokesmen, and I wonder, well, okay, where are the priorities here if we're cutting the people who are the watchdogs and having the PR people, you know, we're beefing. Where are the resources actually going to? And again, you may not have the army of folks to do it, but you are the point person in a lot of these areas. So, where do you see some of the agencies have been heading, and what can we do to reverse that?
Mr. Chairman, that's a good. That is a very valid point. I have found in my 15-year career at the legislature, having worked on this side meaning the legislative side over in the House, as well as at the executive branch, that even in good times, even in the mid-90s when we were flush with cash and every finance committee had big targets, the state government finance committee in either body never got a good target in either body, that it was more attractive for individuals to spend money on K-12 education, on human services, on transportation. And I have now served here under 3 governors, and I have found the same being coming out of a governor's budget, that it's easier to fund the program elements in state government rather than the infrastructure and the people behind the scenes to make the systems go. And I think that your point is valid from your perspective and from what the whatever administration there has been.
Questions or comments from the members? Well, we're going to be spending more time on some of these issues, Commissioner. Well, in just a few minutes, we're going to do the overview of the governor's budget. But if there is nothing further on the response of the legislative auditor, I thank you, Commissioner, and we'll be back again in a few minutes to talk about some other issues relating.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee, for the attention to these issues.
The next thing we have, we are going to start looking at the overview of the governor's budget, but I asked Mr. Lundeen, and you've got a, what do we have? We have 2 documents. Sure, yeah. 2 documents in your packets that kind of give a view of the not only the cuts, but some of the areas where the governor is proposing, you know, for some funding within the areas that we have some oversight. So, Mr. Lundin, could you give us an overview of what we are looking at?
Okay. The first one I'll look at is the 8.5 by 11, which is just kind of highlighting the changes that the governor is recommending in the state government budget area. And I'm not going to go into any detail in talking about any of the individual changes. I think we'll hear some of that, some high-level stuff from the EBOs, and then as we bring in the agencies in the next few weeks, we'll hear even more. But basically on this change item sheet, I have put together all of the general fund change items, those reductions, and where the governor has recommended spending some dollars. As you can see, there's a number of expenditures in technology. And if you go down the sheet, the new general fund spending that the governor is recommending in this division is just slightly more than $43 million. And then the reductions that are made in this area are about just slightly more, or almost $25.5 million, just slightly more than that. And so it nets out over the base in this area of general fund dollars of $17.7 million over the base. If you go down to the bottom of the sheet, I've just highlighted some of the changes that the governor has recommended in the non-general fund items. And I should just point out there is one item that I did neglect as I was sitting here. I realized I had not put on here, and that's in the Office of Enterprise Technology. There is an initiative for the e-licensing project, and there's a surcharge there that will be running through a special revenue fund, and that's for a total of about $9.5 million for this 10 and 11 biennium.
Mr. Chair.
Charles Sean.
Mr. Lundin, on that e-license, does that cover, because I signed on a bill a couple years ago where, like, realtors and stuff are already charged an e-license. Are we going to charge them again, do you know, or is it going to be a double billing? Or because a lot of those, if I remember right, there's like three areas that were established that were paying for that.
At this time, I'm not sure. I have requested some information from OET kind of detailing the licenses and that are going to be surcharged, and I haven't gotten that yet, so I don't know at this point.
We can keep
that was an issue that came up last biennium, and I'm sure it's going to. We went part of the way to start the e-licensing program going, but we didn't finish it off, and obviously that's the issue we have before us, and we have to deal with some of those issues, you know, because they are, you're correct. They're already paying part of the fund for their own system, and this is going to be, you know, we need to have the people who are going to be using the system paying for it. So, but we'll get to that point.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Lundy.
Okay, and then I'll quickly take a look at the other legal-sized spreadsheet that you have, and this is just kind of a high-level kind of looking at the items at the agency level. I do have a more detailed spreadsheet, but I didn't print that out for today's because that's about 16 pages long, but it is posted on the web if anybody is interested in it. And so what I've done here is the first columns are the information from the November forecast, and I have taken into account the unallotments that the governor recently did. And so if you take a look at the first yellow column there, FY09 unallotment, that will just detail by agency the amount of general fund dollars that were the governor unallotted from the various agencies. And then going over to the next column, you have the forecast base. And the next column is the governor's recommendations. And that's where you then can see the difference between the base to what the governor has recommended, whether it's an addition or a subtraction from the base. And then there's the percentage differences there. And then also there's some information on the tails and how that differs between the governor and the base. And I think basically, as I was saying when I was going through the change item sheet, and here this is just looking at the general fund. This is none of the non-general fund dollars showing up here, but the governor is recommending $17.7 million over the base, which is about a 2.8% increase on the base. And then looking out at the tails, the governor's recommendation over the base is just slightly more than $1 million. So I don't know if anybody has any questions, but that's kind of a high-level view of what was recommended.
Any questions on the overview? What this is suggesting is that the I don't know where the $17 million would come in as new money to this budget division, but a lot of this is going to ultimately going to the lease to purchase, which we're going to be hearing about momentarily, proposal where the governor would like to get some of the new technology early on by leasing it, but then we would be paying more for it in the long term for it than we could afford in the short term. So that's what we're going to be looking at when we start getting in the governor's budget right now. So we do have the Minnesota Management and Budget representatives here, and we would like to get a better overview of what is being proposed by the governor. And I think we're particularly interested in knowing some more information about the lease to purchase thing, because, as I said, I don't know whether we have to come up with the money or how much is it going to cost in the long run. But those are just that's one little area. But welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the Division, my name is Abigail Reed. I'm a Budget Officer at Minnesota Management and Budget. And if it works for you, we'll actually introduce all of ourselves, sure, because we'll be jumping back.
Your last name again is?
Reed.
Reed. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mr. Chair, my name is Brian Dahl from Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank I'm you. Also an Executive Budget Officer.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Angela Vogt. I'm also an Executive Budget Officer with the Minnesota Management and Budget Department.
And collectively, we cover all of the agencies within the jurisdiction of your committee.
Thank you. Please
and,
proceed.
We're here today to talk about the governor's budget. We'll provide an overview, starting with some of the slides that the governor presented at his press conference, and then moving into some slides we've added about the specific agencies. And at the end, at the request of the committee, we also will talk about the lease purchase financing a little more.
Okay.
So the first two slides give you a visual representation of what's in the governor's budget. There's a proposed general fund spending of $33.6 billion, and as you can see.
And that's this right here, is it?
Okay. Yep.
Gotcha.
Okay. Slides. The state government portion of that is 1.9. It's in the lower right-hand corner. So we're a relatively small portion of the total. And the next pie chart actually shows that the general fund is only about 57% of the total all funds operating budget for the proposed budget. And that totals $57.6 billion. As the next slide shows, the governor's budget is structured around some top budget priorities. They are to enhance Minnesota's job climate, improve K-12 education, protect state public safety programs, maintain military and veterans programs, and increase government reform and accountability. The governor's budget also includes a number of important financial management goals. These are to restore a portion of the budget reserve. That's $250 million is proposed in the governor's budget, and this is needed to address additional economic risk that we face in future forecasts in the upcoming biennium. Also, the governor's budget maintains the cash flow account at $350 million, which is the statutory limit. And the governor's budget also understates the potential level of federal fiscal assistance. The idea is to not over-project what will actually come so that we have enough options on the table to balance the budget. We wouldn't want to estimate too low a number and then not have all the options we need as session comes to a close to balance our budget. So the governor's budget does include a $920 million placeholder for federal stimulus based on that. And the last item there is actually to improve the structural deficit, looking out to the biennium past fiscal 10 and 11, so that would be the fiscal 12 and 13 biennium. Our current projections do show we would have a deficit then as well. So this budget does make some progress towards addressing that, recognizing that the revenue picture might change quite a bit before then.
Now, the governor used his unallotment authority to spend down the budget reserves, so at this time it's down to zero. So he's proposing to build it back up for the next biennium to at least $250 million. Is that's what he's proposing?
That is correct.
I see. Okay.
So the
yep.
statutory limit, Mr. Chair, is $653 million. This would restore $250 million of that amount.
Okay. Thank you.
So the next slide gives you a shorthand look at how the governor's budget solves the projected deficit during fiscal 10 and 11. So remembering back to the November forecast, there was a shortfall of $4.8 billion. And so what this budget does is address that deficit with a combination of spending cuts and savings for $2.5 billion, other resources for $3.2 billion, and tax cuts at $860 million. Sorry, tax cuts, initiatives, and reserve. $860 million. And that top line there, the spending cuts and savings, that's really $2.4 billion in spending cuts and another $153 million. It's a variety of savings measures, things that you'll see throughout other areas of the budget, like folding the healthcare access fund into the general fund. The other resources line there includes the $1.3 billion from the K-12 payment shifts, the stimulus placeholder we discussed, and also the tobacco appropriation bonds. And the final line there is composed of $323 million in new spending, including some of the items in this area, $287 million in tax cuts, and the $250 million budget reserve. So turning to the next slide, the bottom line then is as you move from the current biennium, fiscal year 2008-2009, that had $34.36 billion in spending, the proposed spending for fiscal 10 and 11 would be $33.61 billion. And that is a 2.2% reduction. And it's important to note that it's difficult to make an apples-to-apples comparison between the two biennia because some of the things that are moving in and out. So you'll see the healthcare access fund is one of those. Also, the tobacco appropriation bonds being used to pay some of the debt service in short term would also be moving things in and out. So important to keep in mind. The next two slides just show some of the key areas of spending in the budget and how they change in the proposed budget. And the first slide shows the difference from the current biennium to the proposed upcoming biennium. And the next one after that shows the difference from the forecast base then to what's proposed in the governor's budget. The following slide, we've added the comparisons for this specific committee. And what you'll see, as Mr. Lindeen mentioned, the bottom part there is the forecast base change actually goes up 2.7. We might have had a round of difference. And the top part of this slide does show the difference from the current biennium to the proposed next biennium. And it's important to note here that when you move from the current to the next biennium, you're seeing actually a decrease because in the current biennium, you're seeing actually some non-direct general fund spending that shows up that isn't actually projected out in the forecast. And when you see an increase from the forecast base, that's really, as the chair mentioned, related to the statewide technology projects. So these are projects of statewide significance that happen to be appropriated in this committee. And the next slide gives a little more detail on what the governor's budget does to address the gap we see coming up in fiscal year 12 and 13.
Okay, you're on page 6 now.
Says plan substantially reduces fiscal 12-13 gap.
Just want to make sure we're all at the same point. Okay, thank you.
And the idea here is to have an eye towards the future to note that we are looking at potential deficits in those years and to start making progress. Also keeping an eye on the current biennium, and if we were to go all the way to try to solve this deficit, it might cause some severe disruption in programs.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the next several slides, we're going to be talking about a variety of the spending reductions that were included in the governor's budget, as well as some initiatives. We'll start out with the cabinet agencies. The Department of Administration has is a $776,000 per year reduction to its budget. Generally, in the cabinet area, in this state government bill, the reduction amount was 5% of their forecast base budget. Just as a reminder and a note that the Department of Administration also has a variety of pass-through grants from public broadcasting and an in-lieu of rent amount in their general fund. So if you took those out of the calculation, their reduction amount is actually a little more than 5%. Minnesota Management and Budget will also be a 5% budget reduction, as will OET. The Department of Revenue is actually a reduction that's calculated in, minus their compliance activities because they generate non-dedicated funds from those activities. In order to reach those targets in the governor's recommendation, the Department of Administration plans. Excuse me.
If somebody's got a BlackBerry, that usually is what causes it. So, yeah.
excuse me. The Department of Administration plans to eliminate 2.5 positions throughout the agency, as well as additional salary and operating budget reductions. They plan to eliminate some external consultants that they have working on their enterprise performance initiatives. And they have also done an analysis that allows them to adjust some of their staff time to non-general funded activities. Management and budget plans to meet their target by eliminating 8 positions throughout the department, as well as reducing their operational costs through space consolidation, server consolidation, and reduction of employee development. OET plans to eliminate 4 FTE through current vacant positions and attrition, and the Department of Revenue plans to eliminate 51 FTEs through attrition and layoffs in their compliance area.
I do have a question. I think because we just looked at just last week, we did get some of the budget information on the Department of Revenue, and some of it was through attrition and some were direct cuts. But I think subsequently the governor made some remark about there being maybe 1,100 people might be laid off, and he thought that a lot of those might come out of the Department of Revenue. So that having difficulty squaring the information we just got and what you just said, of 51 positions in revenue with what apparently the governor is saying about there being far more cuts and layoffs. Is there something else coming out that, you know, apparently that's some remark that he made last week. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's not my area of expertise. Do you want to comment on that? Or
is there somebody?
Well, Mr. Chair, it is supposedly my area of expertise, okay. But I'm going to have to look into that question and get back to you.
Okay.
I'm not sure exactly what the governor is referring to.
Okay. Thank you.
But this presentation does, Mr. Chair, represent what is in the governor's budget
proposed
for that. So if there are additional outside of that, that's what we need to look into.
That's, as I say, it came to my attention. He made some remark like that, and we're just trying to fix because it wasn't squaring with the budget information we're getting. Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, don't we end up losing more money when we lay off compliance officers because that's –
Well, that's
people to pay their taxes.
That's the reason why we ramped up and gave Department of Revenue all that extra money so they could go after the harder-to-find
right.
tax
bring one. In 3-4 times the cost.
Well, it's a diminishing return, but we just had that information last week, and it still is paying off so far. So, okay. Go ahead.
In the next slide, you see in front of you the governor's recommended reductions for the legislature and the constitutional officers. As required by statute, the governor must make recommendations for the legislature and constitutional officers in order to arrive at a balanced budget. To balance the budget, the governor has recommended reductions to total appropriations but doesn't make any specific recommendations as to where those reductions would take place within the agency. As you can see, the legislature first on that list, the $7.85 million constitutes a 5% operating reduction to the base budget, in addition to a reduction for an in lieu of rent amount. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. The Attorney General's amount that is listed there is also a 5% reduction of their operating budget. There is no change to their direct appropriated other funds. These are just general funds only. The governor's office is also a 5% reduction. The Secretary of State's is a 5% reduction from their forecast-based budget, and that changes year over year because their forecast base is actually different between years. And finally, the state auditor's reduction is calculated excluding their audit practice, which recovers its fees 100%. For the audit practice portion. So it's 5% of their non-audit practice amount. Let me talk just a little bit about the in lieu of rent piece. And what that is an increase for that would go to the Department of Administration of $500,000 per year. And what it does is it covers the cost of plant management related to the state capitol building, the state office building, and ceremonial space. In order to give them additional money to fund that portion, we did reductions to the governor's office and the legislature to cover that. They actually haven't received an increase in this area since 2004, and it covers things like the cost of utilities, bond interest, depreciation, salaries, and expenses for maintenance. So all those things have gone up since then. I think that's it.
Okay, before you move on, Senator Rest had a question. But one of the things that we are going to be looking at, members, later on, the governor's office, we've monitored these interagency agreements where people work for one agency but then are assigned to the governor's office. So although they may make cuts, they still wind up getting the people in because they pull them in from somewhere else. So we do want to track to see what people are on paper working somewhere else but still there to make sure that if there's cuts, there's actually cuts. Senator Rust.
Mr. Chairman, that was going to be my line of question as well. By statute, I get the announcements from the governor's office when, as do you, I believe, when there is that interagency transfer of someone into the governor's office whose compensation is still attached to a different state agency, and it would be nice to have all that separated out so that when state agency. We want to know if the state agency is taking a cut for the governor's office, quite frankly, or not. So it'd be good to have eventually some detail in that regard, just so we understand what's happening.
We'll get that at a later hearing when we hear from the governor's office. Okay?
Moving on to the next slide. Title 5% spending reductions, there's a number of small agencies that are on this list, and basically this is just a 5% reduction to their forecast operating base.
And all of these come within our jurisdiction, so we will be hearing from some of these as early as Wednesday. So. Okay. That's our rest.
Mr. Chairman, I have concerns when small agencies that barely can cut it to start with are getting a spending reduction. You know, when an agency gets $100,000 and you cut them by 5%, then they have $95,000 to operate on. That's one thing. But when they have $10,000 just by on a scale, and you cut them 5%, I think they're hard pressed to find that kind of reduction and still. Be true to their mission and be able to function. So I hope that when we look at those agencies that were more surgical than just saying, well, everybody gets 5%, live with it. We don't care whether that means that you can't function. I don't think that's what we want to tell these small agencies, that we're going to cut them a 5% cut, even if it means that they can no longer function, that we're going to do that to them. I don't think I can support that.
Okay, well, as I say, we'll hear from someone Wednesday, so Sarah Robley.
I, on the other hand, would merge all those councils into a council on minorities or something and try and find efficiencies that way.
There are some efficiencies that we will be hearing about later that don't take away the independence of the groups, but that do look for some sharing. But I think we need to be real careful about cutting them to the extent that even if they did what maybe you would like to do, consolidate all of them, that the cut would mean that they couldn't function. I don't think we want to do that.
Mr. Nobles did comment during his presentation that he thought that there were some efficiencies that could be gained by some of these agencies, sharing copy machines, doing other things like that. So whether they merge or just do a better job, I think there's some things that we have to start looking at. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, moving on to the next slide. There are some other smaller agencies where the governor's recommendation will reflect a forecast-based level of spending, no change, basically. The governor's budget keeps the investment board at its forecast-based level appropriation, given its important task of managing the state's investments, particularly during these turbulent economic times. The retirement, contingent, and tort claims accounts all stay at the forecast-based level. three agencies also operate outside the general fund in this area. The Gambling Control Board, the Racing Commission, receive direct appropriations from fees on the industries that they regulate. And the governor's budget keeps these agencies at forecast-based level appropriations, as well as the lottery also is kept at the forecast-based level. Next slide, called Other Spending Changes. The Amateur Sports Commission actually will reflect a partial base restoration. The governor's budget restores some funding to Amateur Sports Commission. Over the last three biennia, the commission has maintained a budget of approximately $300,000 per year, but in recent years, a significant portion of that funding has been appropriated as one-time money. This caused the forecast base to fall to $220,000 per year in FY 10 and 11. The governor's budget restores $50,000 of that per year, which is a 23% increase over the forecast base, but 11% less than the current biennium budget of over $300,000 per year. In addition to the base restoration, the governor's budget also recommends repeal of the standing appropriation provided to the city of Minneapolis to support debt service on the Target Center. That original agreement struck during the 1990s, public takeover of the Target Center was expected to end after 15 years. That would be in fiscal 2009, but no sunset date was written into the law, and so the appropriation remains until it's repealed.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olsen.
This is a question I think more for our committee, but when we just heard about the Combative Sports Commission and the discussion earlier about maybe some of these smaller committees, you know, operating with a shared bookkeeper or accountant or something, would that be appropriate for us to look at something like that falling under the Amateur Sports Commission? Because they talked about their problems with fiscal management and those kinds of things. And I'm just wondering, are we going to be looking at consolidation of this kind of stuff? Or?
Well, yeah. First of all, the combative they're not amateurs. And I think Paul Erickson would certainly would weigh in. I mean, we'll have him before us at some point. He likes to talk about the fact that he doesn't look, you know, he's got a self-paying operation where he doesn't get any appropriations directly from us. But I don't know if there's something that they can do to assist some other entities. I don't know. They kind of like to see themselves as a little thing out there doing their own thing. But
enterprise activity.
Yeah, an enterprise, yeah. But, you know, we have to take a hard look at everything that we're doing and see what makes sense. So he'll be in. Go ahead.
And the next couple of slides basically outline a couple of the governor's initiatives related to the Department of Administration. First on that list is a cooperative purchasing expansion, which would require cities, townships, and counties to use state contracts to purchase goods and services. Those are negotiated by the Department of Administration.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, by statute, Minnesota is part of an 11-state compact called the Midwest Higher Education Compact, and the purpose of that compact was for group purchasing. So I would think at least if we're going to go ahead with this, that we should allow, you know, they do it for higher ed. They also do it for school districts, local governments can be part of the pool, private colleges, and I think nonprofits too. So I think we should at least allow that since that is a statutory relationship that we have with the MEC. Mm-hmm. We should allow that to continue.
And we've previously talked, you know, touched on, we're going to get more detail, but for instance, in Sarah Kubley's district, does it make sense for his school district to have to come down to St. Paul to get their supplies, or should they do it out, you know,
local
where they're
vendors,
at, Sarah
right.
Kubley?
Well, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just piggybacking on Senator Pappas's comments just a bit, you know, my school districts already do cooperative purchasing mm-hmm. through our regional office, but also, I guess, you know, if we're going to require cities, counties, and townships to use cooperative contracts, I would hope that those contracts include delivery of the product to at least a centralized location so that we're not more than spending, you know, the difference in mileage by coming down here to pick it up. That doesn't make any sense at all to me.
Where are you? On your way back home on the weekends, you can just
hold
up your car and
hold your truck.
Make a couple of stops on the way. So, right.
I might not get my weekend in under those conditions, Mr. Chair.
That wasn't part of your job description. Okay. Others. Okay. Well, go ahead.
Okay. Just to mention, all this activity would go on outside of the general fund. The Department of Administration already has a revolving fund wherein this cooperative purchasing activity takes place, so it would just be an expansion of what they already do.
Okay.
Next on the list is the real appropriation for the real property system. The governor's recommendation includes $844,000 per year for ongoing support of this system. This is a system whereby in the 2007 session, they were appropriated $2.5 million for initial implementation and design of this system. In addition, a number of state agencies have contributed $1.825 million for its implementation, so it's an enterprise-wide effort. And this amount expected to be completed largely by summer of 2009, so this amount of money is for ongoing support only. Next slide is, we talked a little bit about the in lieu of rent already. The SMART initiative, you've heard some about as part of a larger oversight initiative by the Commissioner Hansen. The governor's recommended an additional $145,000 per year for the SMART initiative, which works with small agencies to streamline financial management practices and HR practices so that they're in line with state policy.
Well, and, you know, we've heard about them previously, and it's a good program to, you know, help the agencies do the things they can't do for themselves. But how do we, you know, how can the, I guess the bigger question is, how can the executive branch, you know, make sure these little boards do that? Because that's where we're running into the problems, that they're all by themselves, and if they don't take advantage of these shared services and human resources policies and so forth, and you know, they get in trouble. We're going to hear some of those troubles, you know, when some of these small boards come before us. How can we make sure that they actually use these resources that we make available to them? Any thoughts on that?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in the governor's recommendation, we have actually partnered with the Department of Administration, and as EBOs, we have been working with them to identify which small agencies need that extra push to come on board with SMART, and have promised to work collaboratively with them. Mm-hmm. In addition, those agencies that might benefit, in addition to SMART, in addition to the ones that are already being already using that service, are actually outlined in that governor's recommendation. So I think that there's an additional impetus to find out what the service is about and use it.
Sir Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, if we're putting more money into SMART, but we're cutting the budgets of some of the small agencies, will we be increasing, do they pay a lot of money to get the SMART services, or because SMART has its own budget, they don't have to pay a lot of money to kind of get rid of some of the work that they do within their agency and let the SMART group take it over? How does that balance out?
Yeah, good question.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the SMART appropriation for small agencies, as they are identified as small, we have a guideline for kind of how many FTEs are in that agency. Those financial and HR services are provided for free out of this appropriation. So the total of this appropriation would be $395,000 per year, and they would hire a couple of additional people to do that work. SMART also works with some medium-sized agencies whereby they contract with them, and those agencies, if they feel they need those financial and HR expertise that SMART has, they do pay them based upon an interagency agreement.
So if it's free, there's no reason why these small agencies shouldn't be taking advantage of it, I guess. Senator Roebling?
And Mr. Chair, and then the 5% cuts for those small agencies, they're offsetting them by giving them these types of services.
That might make more sense.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see what they got to say. And let's make sure we ask them as they come before us, at least the ones that we have, saying, okay, are you using SMART? And if so, why not? So we'll be hearing from them. Thank you. Please proceed.
One more item on this list of initiatives is $125,000 per year to fund the Office of Grants Management. This office was also originally funded in the same amount in 2008. In order to, what they do is they provide support to the public who are seeking state grants. They also create policies and procedures within state government and provide advice on grant making and monitoring for state agencies. And finally, they do investigate if there are fraud and abuse allegations that come to the state through this agency. They are responsible for investigating that. To maintain their statutory requirements related to grant making and monitoring, the governor's included this amount in his budget as well.
And this area was a mess, and you know, the legislative auditor just said there was just no controls anywhere, and so this office was established. And Commissioner Badgero said that it's working quite well, except, you know, we only give it partial funding, so it's you know, this is something that I actually we put some money in that actually is working. So. Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if you'll look at the next slide, it's the revenue department's only initiative, and that's $2.117 million per year for 10 years using the lease purchase financing for integrated tax system. And I know you had heard from the Department of Revenue on Wednesday.
Well, actually, they kind of punted, you know, and said, well, that somebody today would answer the more detailed questions on it. So,
Mr. Chair, that was actually me that punted on
you did. Okay.
Wednesday.
So what are – so somebody describe to us, okay, who fronts the money? How much does it cost in the long run? I mean, we know that we got to finish off the integrated tax system so we can get all these systems working together. But I'd like to, you know, get a better handle on all the details, and I'm trying to absorb it. So, what can you tell us about it,
Mr. Chair? If you can turn to the last four slides in your packet.
Okay, if you're going to get to it, that's fine. Okay, and why don't you proceed if you're going to be getting to it? Okay.
Well, then going back to the integrated tax system, just sort of as a review. This is the completion of the system that received an appropriation of $12 million from the 2007 legislature. And it replaces 142 computer applications running on 11 different platforms for the 28 different tax types in Minnesota.
And then the next two items are under the Office of Enterprise Technology, and they are two statewide technology systems that would be overseen by OET. The first one is the data center consolidation initiative. This would be $16.5 million one-time funding in fiscal years 2010 and 11. That would be the total for the biennium. And this initiative would reduce the state's IT vulnerability and consolidate most of the executive branch data centers under a single enterprise operation. And the goal of this initiative is really to improve data security and ensure the availability of the state's critical systems. And the impetus for this is that OET and its agency partners actually contracted an in-depth study of the executive branch data centers. And the assessment showed that limited resources over the years combined with decentralized management have actually resulted in the state taking on too much risk in the area of protecting our data and in maintaining our systems, the critical ones, making sure they're available at all times. And so the proposal is to consolidate all the executive branch into a single enterprise operation. It'll likely be one main center with some satellite data recovery centers as needed. And this could actually reduce the square footage quite a bit, energy use quite a bit, and also provide those better disaster recovery capabilities. And this initiative is structured to fund it over the two-year period. This allows us to ramp up this service and then help the agencies transition to paying chargeback rates for it, so that by fiscal year 2012, agencies would actually be paying the full cost of this service. And the assessment actually identified agencies don't currently spend what we will need to spend in order to maintain our state's data and critical systems at the level we should. And so this would help transition to actually spending what we need to on these systems. The second item on this list is the Minnesota Electronic Licensing System. You've seen this before because it was actually begun through an appropriation you made in 2007. And this proposal is to extend that system to the remaining agencies that have business, professional, occupational, and commercial licenses.
And so the proposal is to collect a user fee, which we're estimating at this point to be $38 million over 8 years. And that user fee would be used to expand the system to the remaining agencies. So far, it's being brought online for two pilot agencies. That's using the initial appropriation of $7.5 million. This would then allow us to move to the rest.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, as Harold Seen had raised a question earlier about the real estate licensing, because they had complained previously about that. Where is that issue?
In any cases where an agency has already moved to some sort of online licensing system, they would then have to move to this system under the proposal. I know OET is still studying that issue and could provide more information when they come before you. But the general plan would then be to assess this user fee on all agencies whose licenses will be migrated to the system and then actually move them to the system. In that particular case, they do already have a system that has a surcharge, so that would be phased out and this one will be phased in. How long there might be an overlap is a question that OET would have to address.
Sarah Seen?
You took care of my question. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay, well.
So they will have to pay twice, is that right?
Mr. Chair, members of the division, they will attempt to minimize the amount of overlap. How much there might be, I do not know, and that's
but
something that we take
into
address.
Yes.
To the extent that one system would have to continue until the new one is brought online, there would likely be an overlap, and that is something that needs to be studied further.
It sounds like a yes to me.
Sounds like a yes to me.
Okay, go on.
And just to note, then the surcharge would be structured to be 10% or a floor of $10, and that would be collected over a six-year period for each license that is actually migrated to the system, although the dates would be staggered across an eight-year period just because we don't want to get too far ahead or behind the implementation for each agency.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Officer Roebling.
We're still struggling in the Transportation Department and Public Safety with the I don't think you still can buy your license tabs online, can you? Or now you can? I haven't tried it. I've been mailing mine in because of the problems
you
they had
to
earlier.
Pay extra because they won't take the visa.
Okay. So there's a credit card fee attached to it. I just was wondering if that had been included in the electronic licensing system or not, their system, if that was part of it, but maybe not.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, this system would not cover that area. Those are done through a separate electronic system that's maintained by the Department of Public Safety. This would be limited to business, occupational, commercial, and business licenses. Missing one, professional occupational licenses, that would not include those either recreational or driver's licenses.
Okay, go on.
And the next slide covers two initiatives for Minnesota Management and Budget, and you've heard a bit about these already today. The first one is MAPS replacement, and this is where we're proposing to replace the state's aging accounting and procurement system, and that will provide more stable infrastructure, improved business controls, and better information access and transparency. And as the commissioner mentioned, the existing systems are quite old and are now obsolete and at risk of failure. And so what this would do is actually implement an off-the-shelf software for accounting and procurement that would then allow the state to more easily keep up to date with the technology in this area by not having nearly as many modifications as we do today. And the cost of this system would also be spread over 10 years using lease purchase financing in the governor's proposed budget. And the second initiative on there is the Financial Oversight and Assistance Initiative you heard about earlier. It's $700,000 per year, and that would create the internal control unit as well as increase the amount of staff we have working on oversight of bond authorizations.
Okay.
And in particular, it would add six staff for internal controls unit, and it would add two staff for the bond authorizations. And in that area, the complexity of our bond authorizations has grown quite significantly in the amount as well, but the staff hasn't changed in a few decades. And this is also an initiative addressing a legislative auditor report. So if there aren't any questions on the initiatives, I can turn to lease purchase financing.
Go ahead.
The next three...
Excuse me, Senator Roebling.
The MAPS replacement. Originally, what did we hear that the MAPS system would cost $70 million?
Well, last year, I think it was, what, 56 that we were at, the number we were at, and we didn't do anything last year. Now it's up to, what, 72? I forget what the numbers are right now. It's obviously been going up for the last couple of years, and it's getting more urgent to do something because it's failing on a daily basis, so the map system.
Mr. Chairman, given the state of the economy, it should get cheaper. Competitive bidding.
I can only cite the numbers that people are giving to us. So, and anybody know, can we talk about the numbers for maps? It was about 56 last year, was it, or 53?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that number with me, but I do know it did increase somewhat. You had appropriated some money for the agency to work with consultants to refine the proposal and to do additional risk analysis. The result of that work did show that the cost would be closer to $70 million, and that is what is proposed in the governor's budget. So what you see on this slide here is the annual lease payment of $8.975 million per year. That would be used to pay the principal and interest on a lease purchase financing arrangement for a $70 million system. And I'll have a slide a little later that will show how that breaks down.
So, Mr. Chair?
Sure, Owen.
So we're actually paying about $90 million for it because of the interest on the lease.
Actually, no. If you look at the page 12, the last slide here, and we'll get to that. Under maps, I mean, if we just came up with the money right now, pay for it, it'd be close to $70 million. But by lease to purchase, it'd be about $20 million, I guess, you know, to go that. We add $20 million to the project. So it'll be about $89,750. And then the integrated tax system, again, if we had the money this year to just do it, it would cost $16,500. But if we lease to purchase, you're going to add about another $5 million to that. So it's going to be a total of $19 million. And then it's got the annual payments at the bottom. So that would be the cost of the lease to purchase.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Roblin.
Have we ever considered contracting out for the services instead? But are there security issues? What would keep us from looking at that instead of having our own system in-house?
Good questions. Let's see.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, I know the agency has looked at a variety of options and could definitely comment on that when they come before you. I don't have it with me today.
We're going to hear a lot more about lease to purchase. So.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Sir Goodley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, is there only one vendor for this MAPS hardware? Or
I don't know.
I mean, you know, I guess I'm curious as to, you know, I mean, if it's going up that much in 1 year, mm-hmm. you know, I just wonder if there's only one.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I do not know how many vendors they expect to have in the market. I know the RFP has gone out recently, and once that comes back, they would know much more about the options. But my understanding of the increase in the cost over the last year is actually a refinement of our understanding of the project and what it would entail.
So apparently the specs, Mr. Chair, are not the same as they were the year before.
I don't know.
In meeting that.
It sounds like, if I heard right, the money that we appropriated to keep the system going caused them to do some more analysis, and that's why they came back with a higher number. I thought we were just buying a lot of duct tape last year, but apparently, you know, because the system really has to be replaced. So, Ms. Reed or somebody else, did you want to?
And I apologize. I don't have any more information on the exact cost, so that's something that the agency could address when they come.
The slide at the top of page 12 talks about it's not backed by the full faith and credit of the state like GO bonds would be, therefore it's slightly riskier for investors who demand a higher interest rate. So we're going to be paying a higher interest rate on lease to purchase at 5% than we would normally do under GO bonds. Is that how it's structured?
Mr. Chair, the lease purchase financing tool is an option for getting upfront capital for IT system projects. And then how that works is that we would pay a lease rate over 10 years. So the investors that invest in this financing tool would then get that fixed rate of return. We are currently estimating that the interest rate that the market would demand is 5%, and that is how this initiative was structured. We're very much hoping it would come in at less than that. Mm-hmm. But given the market conditions these days, estimating that is tricky. However, we're quite confident in the 5% and that hopefully it will come in less than that.
And so on the bottom slide at the bottom of page 12, if we go this particular route, we lock in with the numbers that we currently have now, then the state would be obligated for the next 10 years on MAPS to pay the $8,975,000, and for the integrated tax system, we would be obligated to pay the $2,117,000. So that would get the system going up now, but for the next 10 years, we'd have, including the next budget, the 2 years of the budget, we'd have to make those payments. Is that what this is? Okay.
Mr. Chair, how it works is the standing appropriation would need to be created in statute, and okay. That would provide the money needed to pay the lease payments.
Okay. Sarah Roebling.
So then we would own it, it sounds like. What kind of a life expectancy does a system like this have? I know our last one has been around for quite a number of years, but do you have any idea? So once we own it, how many more years of use could we get out of it, do you think?
Again, I'll have to refer that question, Senator, to the agency. I can definitely pass that on as something they could present when they come. But typically, these two projects that the lease purchase financing are recommended for are projects that are expected to have a very long life compared to other technology systems. That's part of the reason they're recommended for this kind of financing, whereas some other projects were not. The lease purchase financing is a tool that we found in talking with other states does work well for those core critical IT systems that are expected to last quite a long time, and the kind that you just can't get through the day without. And the accounting and procurement system and the integrated tax system, they collect the money we need to spend, and they make sure the money that we are spending is accounted for. These are things we cannot operate without, and therefore this is a financing tool that is recommended for those systems.
We do have your office memorandum from the Minnesota Management and Budget dated January 27th that kind of has some questions and answers on lease purchase for technology. So members, you know, at your leisure, you may want to just look at that, maybe put that in your packet if you want to refer to it later on. Other questions? Does that complete your presentation?
Mr. Chair, if I could just cover one more slide.
Sure.
It's the first one titled Lease Purchase Financing. It has benefits, drawbacks, and the bottom line.
Yes. Okay.
This attempts to summarize the document that you were holding there with the questions and answers, and it really kind of gives the overview of how lease purchase financing would work for the state. The benefits are definitely that we could spread the development cost and the budgetary impact of these core critical systems across the life of those systems, so that although we need to build them right up front here, we need the cash up front to build them, it would actually spread the budgetary impact across several biennia, which really does reflect the importance of these systems and the economic times that we are in. The drawbacks, like any kind of borrowing, there's a long-term obligation that we're creating for the state, and there's added interest and administrative expense, and there is a smaller increase in risk and uncertainty just because we would be going to the market with this. But the bottom line really is that this is a viable option for accessing capital for these critical systems when they need to be built, which is now, and that we can do that even in times when our state's economy is in trouble.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Olsen.
I've been interested in IT bonding, which you can't hardly do because of the life of the whatever you're purchasing. But I believe a pretty large city in the state just was able to do an IT bond on some emergency radio type stuff. And so I'm interested if, you know, the industry might be changing because some of the shelf life, as Senator Roebling was alluding to, this is a capital investment, but it may last 20 years. And if there might be some bonding available for IT projects under, I think they might have gone with GO bonds. I'll have to check into that more.
We've raised a question here a couple of times before, but is there somebody over in your agency that can talk about whether bonding can be done for technology? I think that people around here have been talking about it, and I've been hearing conflicting things. If your bond council's
said no in the past.
Never going to do it, and I've heard other people saying, well, they might, but I don't know, and that's obviously something within your agency. Is there somebody who can give us some more information on that?
Mr. Chair, I can provide an overview of that issue and then pass on any more specific questions you have to other
folks.
Does
it go beyond no?
The short answer is no in terms of general obligation bonding.
Okay.
And the key there is really our Minnesota Constitution. It does actually limit general obligation proceeds use to, and I'm going to quote, so sorry, to acquire and to better public buildings and other public improvements of a capital nature. And our bond council has consistently found that that actually means buildings, land, things of that capital nature, and that although technology systems are generally considered to be capital investments, they don't fall under the strict legal definition that's necessary under our Constitution. There's a legal criterion for bond councils that is actually much higher level of legality than you might find in other contexts, and our bond council has consistently found that technology systems don't meet it. And so what is proposed in this budget is actually a viable alternative to achieve many of the same benefits of geobonding, but with the slightly higher risk does beg a slightly higher interest rate.
Bond council tend not to be very creative or flexible, Senator Robley.
I think also in the past they've allowed some local governments to use those five-year anticipation notes, which is not, you know, because of the short term of it, it's not a it's not a long-term bond, but it still allows a longer period than just purchasing technology and allows them a greater length of time to pay it back.
Thank you. Any other questions for this agency? Well, we may have some other questions later on, but thank you for coming. And as I say, on Wednesday, it's the various councils of color. The small agencies will be talking about their, they'll be telling us about how the budget's recommendations will affect them. We'll have questions about the legislative auditor's findings about them, and those are ways that they can do things more efficiently. And Senator Roblin, you may want to inquire about whether or not we could do better with one agency instead of multiple ones. That's what we're going to be talking about on Wednesday. So, okay. Anything else? Well, if not, the meeting's adjourned. Thank you.
Nothing.
See you Wednesday.